And that's the imperialism, the epistemic imperialism that Jordi was talking about. And of course, this doesn't just occur because of the ways in which the hermeneutical resources interact with each other, but because of patterns and history of injustices that exist in the world, which is the non-ideal context in which we have to conduct scientific studies.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our newest episode of About Logic. And today we shifted the organization a little bit. We have two guests and not two moderators. And then maybe that's a more nice way. Maybe otherwise we had in one episode the comment, this looks like a cross-examination. But I'm telling this because this is one of the many themes we will touch today, like how to design things, how get everybody to contribute. But before jumping into the topic, let me first introduce our two guests. Sungyong Song is a professor at Tilburg University, and Jordi Verhelst is currently visiting the KU Leuven, but is normally affiliated with the University of the Balearic Islands in Palma. And we know each other for quite a while. We did some project together, met at conferences, and I'm very happy that you joined our little podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. I hope I will be able to provide you with some nice insights.
We're quite positive about that. And also about like some other perspectives, because today is not only mathy episode, but the math will, of course, still play a role. Yeah, let me start with a very rough invitation to introduce yourself. Would you like to say like 2-3 sentences what you're normally doing, and maybe then also what are you doing where philosophy of math comes more into play? So Sungyong first maybe.
Okay. Hello everyone. So I'm Sungyong Song. I'm based in Tilburg University in the Netherlands. I conduct research in three broad themes, but they're all related. So first thing is I do something called theories of justice, specifically concerns of justice that last across generations, so long-standing issues. And I apply that to issues that relate to two things. One is knowledge, which is the reason why I'm here, because obviously mathematics and mathematicians and their academic output is related to knowledge-making or knowledge production processes. And the other one is language, which is also something that I do research quite a bit. So those two are my field of expertise.
I'm Jordi, as Dennis mentioned previously. So first, thank you for having us on. This is always very fun and enjoyable to have. So I primarily work in, maybe I could say, three fields. One is moral philosophy. So I was very interested in ethical questions and especially meta-ethical questions. The other field is social epistemology, which ties into some of the concerns that Sungyong raised. So the interest not only in knowledge as a form of production, but social activity that has social factors that come into play and can transform how certain things occur. And then the last one ties into this kind of issue that's informal logic, argumentation theory, where I'm interested primarily in disagreements, where it's the issue where two individuals may lack enough resources to transact arguments, and that generates disputes that seem to be longstanding. So I'm interested in like the social elements that go into play in these disputes and how we can navigate them. And that ties into at least a case of mathematics, very broadly construed, with an interest on the one hand in like social factors that affect mathematical knowledge production, and on the other hand, an interest in the mathematical disagreements and how to navigate these disputes.
Okay, cool. So let me pick up this last disagreement word, because in our channel we have a long-running disagreement among all of our guests, that's constructivism versus classical logic. But today it's not about that disagreement. But you have a lovely paper about another disagreement in mathematics, which might be even surprising for some people that people even talk about disagreements in math, namely one about the ABC conjecture, right? Would you be willing to give like a rough upshot for those who don't know the ABC conjecture, what happened there, and then follow up with your take?
Yeah, so both Sayan and I are writing on a paper that's trying to discuss the matter of deep disagreements in mathematics and trying to break out whether there's anything of profit that we can generate in these disputes, whether they're worthwhile, whether we should stay away from them. So in the case of the ABC conjecture, what we're particularly interested in is some sort of case study to see how we could, to some extent, reinvent history. So the ABC conjecture, it all stemmed from, I remember his last name, but I always forget his first name. But it's basically, Mochizuki had this proposal where he basically claimed that through his theory, the ABC conjecture could finally be proved, and we were all happy and jolly about the situation. But then some critics appear saying that there was certain faults, there were certain errors throughout the proof that needed to be addressed, and some of the corollaries, and that gave rise to this kind of disagreement between both parties, where Mochizuki was still convinced of the truth of his theory, and Schultz and Stix were quite critical of it. And to be critical of it, they were using sort of a simplified version of Mochizuki's theory, just because the Intermüller, what is it, Intermüller? I always forget the second name. It's quite complex. It's hard to understand. It's hard to grasp. So they thought the simplification would make things easier. Mochizuki had this kind of response where he was saying, like, on the simplified version, I agree that there is an issue, but my theory is not the simplified version, so the objections do not hold. I still think that my theory is correct. It proves what I want to prove. It basically stalemated there, where we have one side that's like, we do not think that this is knowledge. And on the other hand, another party that says, I think this does constitute knowledge, and it is a published paper, as far as I remember. So technically is within the realm of what we regard as knowledge. But it generates this very interesting scenario where we have a dispute that we can call deep, in the sense that it's irresolvable. Parties have never bridged the gap between their ways of understanding Mochizuki's theory. And what's interesting is that they seem to not even agree on who is a good candidate to resolve the disagreement. So Mochizuki famously said in one of his blogs, it's like, the amount of people that that can understand and properly evaluate my theory and the order of 10, which really closes in who is part of the mathematical community. And Schultz and Stix clearly have a broader understanding of what mathematicians can understand Mochizuki's theory and provide criticisms of it. So the reason that we chose this case, and then this is when I'll pass it on to Senya now, is because we have loads and loads and loads of we have loads of data about their interactions. So they interacted via blog spots, they interacted via conferences, and we have the reports of the conferences. So we have all this information regarding how they spoke to each other, the ways in which they spoke to each other, when the communication started to break down, what kind of issues they held about each other, because sometimes we have disagreements, but it's not very transparent where we are going wrong. And this was a very different kind of scenario. So what we want to evaluate is whether this dispute could have been carried out differently, and what kind of social and contextual conditions were required for the dispute to be a fruitful one. So I generally focus on the epistemological side, which has to do with what kind of shared knowledge do these people require? Do they need to share certain views about who is a good mathematician, for example? But on the other hand, Senyan is interested in other issues that come up in the disagreements, and this is where I join Vince, is this the social identity side. So is there issues about attributing credibility to people and so on, which is, as we know, important because mathematics is very testimonial, evidence-based sometimes. So this is when I'll pass the torch over to Senyan, where she can talk about how social identities can affect knowledge production, and so on.
So I agree with Jordi that this case is very interesting, because we have this understanding that especially for hard science and scientific disciplines that purport certain objectivity, as mathematics does, we assume that such as things such as discrimination or bias will and or prejudices towards certain identities will not exist. But I think what this case illustrates is that there is surely certain problematic conducts that appear during the process of knowledge production. So the field that exists within analytic philosophy that really delves deeper into the ways in which social identity plays a role in knowledge production is called epistemic injustice debate. And epistemic injustice debate is a subfield within social epistemology. So just to provide a very brief account, which involves, of course, for sure, simplification, there is this understanding that when knowledge is produced, there are multiple sources. One can be reasoning, such as induction. The other can be testimony, and so on. And within the epistemic injustice debate, we focus on testimony-based knowledge, which relies on interactions with people who we believe to be credible knowledge givers. And here what happens is that there is identity that is at play that contextualizes the interaction between supposed knowledge givers. And if a knowledge giver is contextualized through a specific body, so they're always embodied, right? Or they are contextualized by specific culture that they might rely on in order to, you know, impart certain knowledges or knowledge. What happens is that the receiver, just a hearing end, must provide justifiable level of credibility, but sometimes this fails. And that's because of the perceived prejudices about the knowledge giver on the basis of their social identity. So that's the whole intuition that epistemic injustice debate tries to establish, and also, of course, to explain how this sort of problems can be resolved.
Maybe one tiny little footnote. I mean, the literature is broader, but n equals one. I found it astonishing for reflecting myself. I don't even know what the ABC conjecture says. I have no idea about it. I have not even opened a paper. But when Scholz and Stick said, oh, there is an error, there, at that moment, I was already convinced, right? So the testimonial side of things is really more important than we say. This ideal of looking into every detail is a rather optimistic one, so to say. And, I mean, the vast amount of my mathematical knowledge is just from hearsay, so to speak. Of course, I'm not a proper mathematician, but even for them, of course, their narrow field, they can understand better than I do. But for other branches at these days, it's not often the case that a mathematician knows a lot about more than one branch, so to speak. So that's an interesting part that I found in myself, interestingly.
Yeah. No, I mean, we do know that, I mean, there's quite a lot of good research showing that testimonial evidence plays a very important role in mathematics. We know that peer review is not blind peer review, which, although it need not be a determining factor logically when you read a paper and you know that it's written by a certain person from a certain institution, then certain evaluations may follow, both negative and positive. And I mean, not always do we regard it as, like, a lot of the times it's purely a pragmatic thing that we do as humans. So if I organize a conference and I get 300 submissions and I have 10 spots, then it's likely that I might prioritize certain institutions over another, just because I know that it might be certain guarantee of quality and so on. But what Zenyan and I are very focused on is showing that like these kind of shortcuts that we take through identities can sometimes be very detrimental in knowledge production. And I think the clearest case that we can think about, and you already had him as a guest, which is perfect for us because we can redirect people. So Colin spoke about the case of epistemic injustice more generally in mathematics. And we see these kind of patterns in science in general, where certain identities are given priority, especially white European men are given a lot of priority, which means that the kind of research questions that we find interest in, the kind of projects that we delve into, is partly determined by the identity of these people, which excludes other perspectives that can be as equally valid but are not given a voice because it's from an identity that is not given the right amount of credibility. And I mean, the ABC conjecture to some extent is that, I mean, the reason that we listened to Mochizuki to some extent was because it's Mochizuki. If it would have been a PhD student that wrote it and submitted it, it would most likely have been discarded immediately because of the pretense of trying to do everything. Like, I'm thinking how sometimes you see on field papers, for example, some paper by an independent researcher, and it won't be given any kind of time. So it's these kind of issues that, it generates a lot of injustice to understand how identities shape supposedly objective sciences. Yeah.
Yes, so maybe if you correct me if I'm phrasing it wrongly. I mean, in some sense, a lot of attention was given in the beginning, right? We had these four papers, which were very weird, linking to or citing preprints that are unpublished, and weird heuristical elements. Say, I think there is some line like the ABC conjecture is the most trivial application of this theory, which is not usual, right? Normally you would expect to prove other things first that are more easily toy examples, and you build up continuously to the big theorem. And here it's a very weird situation, and as you said, but it's this guy who I'm not sure where he did his PhD, if it was in Bonn or wherever, but it's with credentials. And so we listen first. And at some point, this breaks down. We don't listen anymore. The community is split. So there's this lovely saying, the theorem holds in Japan and in some parts of Edinburgh, and it doesn't hold elsewhere, right? Which is another weird situation, so to speak.
So this is quite interesting, actually. So the case that you were just talking about is in the beginning how this papers garnered much interest might be the case of something called credibility access. So there is too much credibility that is granted to those with certain reliable, say, institutional affiliation or authority within the field and so on, which, like you said, might be mitigated through a procedural attempt to verify the veracity of certain claims, right? Or the strength of certain claims. But what we can also surmise is that the inverse or the opposite could also happen, where, for instance, certain mathematicians, because of who they are, because of where they are situated in, and because in which language that they conduct their scientific studies, they might be provided not credibility access, but they might be credibility the deficit that is playing a role when they enter into a global scientific arena. And what happens is that their findings might not receive enough attention, or their findings might be sidelined compared to those who come from prestigious, you know, like situations. And importantly, when it comes to credibility deficit, it's like It's surprisingly very common. It's a common phenomenon that we experience because, as we said, we're talking about knowledge production that occurs on the basis of testimonial exchanges. And like you said, this is something that happens and something that we take for granted quite often. So, for instance, when we go to conferences, we listen to some people who are professors, some wherever. We've never met them. We have no means to verify them on the basis of status and the basis of certain merit that we project onto them. We take for granted the state of the art that they provide on the literature and assume that we can build a certain understanding about the topic that they're presenting us with. This happens earlier on, not only at the level of tertiary education, but primary and secondary education as well. And it also happens outside of the educational context where we just go around and interact with people. For instance, if I were to ask you, Dennis, how old are you? And you will respond with a certain number. I have to assume that you are a credible knowledge giver about the knowledge that we may have as a social group about who you are, because you are the most competent knowledge giver. But sometimes we just don't trust people when they provide whatever they think is, you know, like a justified belief, because for X, Y, and Z. But the problem is, okay, this occurs quite frequently. This occurs at an everyday setting. But when we look at to whom these credibility deficit occurs, it often is patterned. So they look similar, or they share certain similar traits, or they share certain similar social context that they often embody. And the problem is that this sort of patterns also exists at the level of academia.
Yeah, I think the clearest example that, so in the case of mathematics, we know there's sort of, to some extent, we could call it a culture of mathematics. So there's certain methods that are prioritized, but not only methods of proof, which do change over time, but rather there's also stylistic elements that come into play. And this means that if you are rule abiding within a given period, your work would be accepted. But if you're not rule abiding within that period, you'll likely be excluded from the mathematical conversation. And as Senyon points out, so we have, I don't want to butcher the name, but so it's Ramanujan who had this situation where he was dealing with problems that mathematicians had. He dealt with the problems, now we know, in quite an outstanding fashion, but he was excluded from the conversation because he was not abiding by the mathematical culture of the time. And that's primarily tied to his identity as a non-white European. He was basically, okay, you're not doing what we are doing. You're saying something weird. It's even like satirized now to the point of like, it was revealed to me by God kind of scenarios. But his work was a lot more complex than that. He seemed to get things on the right foot very often. So we see in these kind of cases that we don't commonly associate to hard sciences and especially mathematics, but it is an important trait of the field. And this is, again, I cannot recommend enough Colin's podcast on the same kind of issue, where they delved into this kind of scenario more in depth with cases.
And it can be very basal things, right? Like not using LaTeX but ASCII. And some people are already so known, like Friedman, he writes long ASCII things via an email list, no peer review, nothing. But we know that person, so we listen. And otherwise, if I get an ASCII email, I mean, I might be more tempted to ignore it than a proper typeset paper. And the Ramanujan case is also very interesting because even back then, but I'm not entirely sure, there were also some critics of, so to give the story, then, I mean, you know it, there's this person from India sending letters to the UK, huge number of theoretical results, some new, some reproven, and then being invited by Hardy to Cambridge. Right. And Hardy Little were the two biggest number theorists of the time. And Hardy took the time to teach him proof, to put it into this usual corset that even back then some people said you might have destroyed a lot, because there was this person with the other standards of rigor, whatever it is, coming up with 1,000 good ideas. And now we force them to only come up with 100 good ideas, but write them as we would like. And it's like a waste of resources. And other would say, no, that was exactly right. Otherwise, this is just garbage. And now it's proper math. And it's a very weird situation to be in.
Yeah. I think this ties into something. I was actually going to pass it on to you, Senyon. This ties into something that Senyon has worked that's about, I guess, some level of like epistemic imperialism.
I think that was a good bridge. And this was something that I was also thinking about while listening to Dennis's description. So one of the things that social epistemology, or let's say more closely epistemic injustice debate, what they focus on is how this happens. So because we cannot always appeal to, like this idea of prejudice or bias, or like, let's go a bit inch further and say racism or sexism, and say that the reason why people don't give credibility to certain knowledge givers is because of these reasons. Yes, fine, this could be the case, but it's not always that there's these rotten apples in the whole basket that causes the problem. Some people say that there could be a more broader reasons, like structural reasons behind it. And that made these scholars look into not only the testimonial aspect, but also something called a hermeneutical aspect of what it means to build knowledge or what it means to produce knowledge. And basically, there are many different camps about this issue. So some people think that there is one shared hermeneutical resource among all the people, which I would like to say it has been kind of not the mainstream anymore, because there is a better understanding, better updated understanding of what it means to participate in the knowledge-making process. And that assumes that there are multiple like pockets of hermeneutical resources, basically, which overlaps and kind of merges with each other. And the analogy that is often provided in order to understand how these hermeneutical resources exist is something akin to like clouds. They are clearly differentiable from each other, but sometimes they overlap, and sometimes it's merged in the sense that you cannot really tell which one's which and cannot really tell apart. In the similar way, there are resources out there that we try to make intelligible about the things that we experience, about the things that we want to clarify. And mathematics is a great example, because what we want to clarify is the world, basically, how the world is built, right? How the world is supposed to be communicated to each other, how we try to verify that certain assumptions are true, whatever. What happens is that often these one particular hermeneutical resource among different resources may be exaggerated so that it eclipses the other resources. And that's the imperialism, the epistemic imperialism that Jordi was talking about. And of course, this doesn't just occur because of the ways in which the hermeneutical resources interact with each other, but because of patterns and history of injustices that exist in the world, which is the non-ideal context in which we have to conduct scientific studies. Just as a clarification, by hermeneutical, I'm talking about meaning-making activities that also, for instance, constitute a very important part of science. So for a very great example is hard science that tried to explain why is it that there is, for instance, speed, and what does it mean to have different types of speed, and what they try to do is to formalize it, right? And that's the meaning-making process. And of course, in order to make things intelligible to each other, what we rely on is a certain language or a certain shared conception of what it means to have speed et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And for the case of mathematics, yeah, what we see primarily is the idea that there's certain standards for proof, there's certain standards for what academic writing is, there's certain standards for all these different elements that constitute what makes mathematics mathematics in the present time. So a very clear example, I think it shows that it can be something very complex, like mathematic methods. So that's methods of proof. So that's something that Dennis pointed out very well, like you're forcing somebody to jump into another hermeneutical bubble. So it's like they're learning to play the game they've played all their life, but with different rules, and it suddenly becomes very hard. It's a bit like if an English person suddenly bought a mainland Europe and they've asked to drive, and it's like everything's upside down now. Like I can do it, but it's a lot harder than what it was. And what's quite interesting is that this can happen with very complex things like methods of proof and so on, but it can also happen with very basic things such as language. So it's we know that it's not uncommon for people to negatively evaluate a paper because the English is not up to Oxford standards, basically. And that's another situation in which we see that certain prejudices can surface, and it's like, I've seen it as a reviewer, and I've seen it as an editor, and I've seen it as an author, where you have these comments of like, this paper cannot be evaluated because like the English is beyond understanding. And it's generally not the case. It's clearly understandable. And I mean, in mathematics, it generally is even more understandable because at least there's a shared formal language we can all sort of get along with roughly. But it's again, these kind of elements where like, if the hermeneutical space of mainstream mathematical knowledge is with certain rules, and certain people can't abide by those rules because of certain past injustices and so on, or because of social identities and any of these kind of elements, then it basically means that we are making a certain mathematics that excluding perspectives without real justification for it. Which I think the small clarification that we always have to make, it doesn't mean that the mathematics that we are making now is bad mathematics or that it's false mathematics and so on. It's rather that it's one way of doing mathematics. And by prioritizing that way of doing mathematics, we can be excluding perspectives that are equally as right, but maybe interesting for other purposes with other kind of questions, other kinds of problems, other kind of paths to take.
And I try to, I mean, now narrowing it down back, Western context, the established proof standards, and we have a big disagreement in this podcast, and one that already came up with an episode, it's likely published already when this comes out, with André Bauer, and Joel Hemkins, who's invited and a lovely person who will probably join, hopefully, otherwise we cut this out. and they disagreed on something, and if I butcher it up, Thorsten will kill me, but let me still try it. There's a logical difference for the intuitionistic mathematician between a refutation, so I assume A, I get to a contradiction, so I get to non-A, it cannot be. And that's fine for the intuitionist. What's not fine for him is, or for her is, I start with non-A, I get to a contradiction, thus A must hold. This doesn't work for the intuitionist. For the classical mathematician, same thing. Potato, potato. So the classical mathematician just says proof by contradiction, while the intuitionist would like to distinguish this because one thing is valid and the other isn't. And then people got heated. I mean, as heated as you get in mathematics, it's still not politics in the West sense. And they said, oh, this is wrong. We should change the Wikipedia. We don't distinguish that. And some classical mathematician, maybe I singled out Joel Hemkins, said, don't over embrace this issue. It's a nuance. It's a correct nuance. I'm fine with it. But there's no reason to go to the first year BA students and already push them too much, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I mean, similar, only within set theory, classical math, the axiom of choice is a delicate issue, and normally we just do the dance once. We said, oh, well, here we use the axiom of choice, and then we don't give a damn and just use it or don't use it. Who cares? I don't know. And this, I mean, maybe you don't have any strong intuition. I mean, there's no right or wrong here. I think both ways, I guess at least, maybe I'm already butchered for that. But what's your feeling about this issue? Is this something relevant for you, or am I just saying something trivial and missing the bigger picture?
I think it's very relevant because the ABC conjectures, not ABC, set theory is actually a case that we are interested in as well, because there has been a few papers discussing set theory as a deep disagreement where I think it's primarily Andrew Aberdeen and also Deborah Kant that was also on the podcast talking about set theory. So we do have researchers that are working on this kind of disagreement. And as you rightly point out, it seems to be the closest thing we have to politics and mathematics, where it's like very heated disagreements over like, oh, well, can I have extra axioms or not? Can I take this? And I think the point that you raise is actually quite interesting because, yeah, we were talking about like hermeneutical bubbles in the term, in terms of like cultures and societies. So the hermeneutical bubble of the West is very different to the hermeneutical bubble of other regions of the world, and we should not be exclusionary to other ways of doing things. And a lesson that maybe we would like to take from these kind of cases, such as set theory, is that at the end of the day, there are different ways of approaching similar problems. And by acknowledging that there might not be a necessary right choice or the correct one to exclude the other, and simply allow both practices to surface and to develop their work in the ways that they do, it might be very, 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 very positive for mathematical knowledge in general. It just means that we're generating more things. It would generate interesting questions that may even overlap. And another thing that we talk about in the paper, about the case at least of set theory, is that sometimes even having these kind of opposed sides can be very, very beneficial for the mathematicians themselves. So the idea is that generally if we work within a community where there's just total consensus, our knowledge production can actually be worse in the sense of we will struggle to deal with confirmation bias, because if I take my paper to you, Dennis, and you like it and you say, ah, this is great, all these like little small mistakes or small imprecisions will never come out, and we'll just walk together and say like, ah, we both agree on this adamantly and there's no issue. But if we do have practices in mathematics where there is long-standing disagreements, then these kind of imprecisions in the knowledge production will sort of start to be ironed out, because we will have somebody on the other side being very picky about, well, no, that's actually not the case. But I think the line that we need to not transgress is invalidating the way that the other does it. We can point out, hey, this is not up to the standards, I believe, and the other person can revise it, but we need not do that while just silencing perspectives. But it does bring in something interesting in this, I think, ties well into saying in the section on the paper that for these kind of things to happen, there needs to be certain individuals need to have certain epistemic character in terms of virtues and vices. So it's not merely a matter of knowledge, but also a matter about how individuals approach knowledge in their practices. So I don't know if you want to add something about
maybe
this.
Can boil it back down to this more naive question? Now you brought it again bigger to this proper disagreements between, let's say, classical, not classical math. Because I just really wanted to talk about the very small linguistic point, and knowing your work on linguistic injustice, maybe this is simply too trivial, so just you can reject my question, no hard feelings. Do you have a intuition there? Would you side with the minority, the constructivist, who have the right to point out a difference for them? Or is that nothing where we should use the big work of injustice for? And this is just a trivial pragmatic question, so thank you. Do you have a 2 cents to chip in?
Yeah, so I think that's actually a very long-standing inquiry in theories of justice, because within our field, there is a distinction between wrongs, harms, injuries, and injustice. And all these terms denote something different. And your question was, there are two camps in mathematics, one that defends one way of understanding, and the other one defends otherwise, and there is a dispute, you know. And then basically the question is, would you say that the minorities, so the constructivists, are they facing an injustice? In order to answer this question either as a yes or no, what we have to see is whether this is first sporadic, second incidental, whether it's patterned, whether it's long-standing, etc., etc., etc. So what happens is that if a harm occurs, it's not always a wrong, right? So a doctor can harm you by cutting off your arm, but he's not wronging you. In the same way, in the academic world, something can occur which can be harmful, where we lose out in certain truths, but it may not be wrongful in a sense that it did not harm certain, let's say, dignity of the scientists involved. But it could be harmful at the level of the academic collective and so on. The question that you wanted to ask was whether there was like a, let's say, an injustice, which is of a bit more of a collective level, if these minorities who are rejected depict a certain identity or a certain group membership that had a long-standing history of mistreatment or exclusion from the dominant mathematic field, then we can perhaps say that this points to something greater.
Just my two cents, having this refined vocabulary. I think in the past it was easier to see proper injustice there, because we have these historical case studies of people being excluded systematically, not getting positions because of intuitionistic tendencies. So I think there it's well documented. And nowadays it's a proper empirical question just to see whether this is a wrong because of the epistemic benefit of the young learners who shouldn't distinguish too much things, or whether it's an injustice, or maybe it's an injustice because it's a reflex, it's paternalized just to not look at the constructive distinction. And we will probably not know. And Twitter is dead, but the discussion will continue elsewhere. X is dead. Maybe I should say that Twitter is anyway, sorry.
But what I wanted to achieve is that there are certain factors that you can consider to judge for yourself whether it is an injustice or not. Because, of course, the crowd will differ, right? Because it's already a polarized crowd. But what I can offer to you is that these are the normative factors that you can judge to see whether this exclusion is justifiable for consequential reasons, or it is not justifiable because it constitutes a certain pattern which might result in an injustice. Something that had happened in the past, if it resembles in the present, the resemblance itself sometimes gives a justification enough to stop that practice, right? The Nazi salute, it was used for a specific reason. This Elon Musk doing it, you shouldn't do it for a reason, not because of his ideological tendencies, but because it's just simply a symbolic that you should no longer use, right? So, you can cut this part out if you want.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you prefer. I think you can insist on that, and we do it otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay. So sorry for bringing this back to this smaller linguistic question. I think that helped. But let me ask, like, as a final topic, because we are already running out of time, like, is there also a positive story? What can we do? What can we learn? What are other ideas that you develop, in particular, maybe in this context, set theoretic disagreement?
So the paper that we have on deep disagreements, the whole point about it is to show that when we have these long-standing disputes that may be tied to either different ways of doing mathematics, whether that be within a shared hermeneutical bubble or between different hermeneutical bubbles, we do like to end the story with like some positive treatment of like, what can we do, what can't we do? And we talk about the improvements in knowledge that these disagreements have. So as mentioned earlier, like it allows us to combat confirmation bias. Sometimes by responding to harsh critics, we tend to generate new knowledge. So if I have an objection that I didn't have previously and I address that objection, then maybe I generate something new. So imagine if Mochizuki, instead of saying like, shoals and sticks do not understand what I say, but rather said, I'll take this as a real opportunity to improve my theory, then we have this very interesting moment that's like, now new knowledge is being produced. This is very, very beneficial to the discipline as a whole. But our contention is, for these things to happen, there needs to be certain epistemic attitudes by the people involved. And by that, we mean that if I want a disagreement between set theories to be beneficial, the people involved in the disagreement need to act in certain ways that enable these good things to happen. So one of the clear ones is this idea of epistemic humility, that's sort of having a certain awareness about your own ideas and the fact that you may be wrong or that you may not have all the truth in your side. So that means that in the case of set theory, we know that both sides are very adamant that they are right and that they are fundamentally right about the issues that they're dealing with. But our contention would be that when you're having a disagreement with somebody on the other side, what you need to do is take a step back and say, hey, maybe I'd be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe a different way of doing set theory can be beneficial to me. Maybe hearing how another person does set theory can be beneficial to me. And these kind of interactions will generate something more interesting. But I also want to posit to Sengyun, because it's not only about the character regarding your own ideas, but also your character with regards to possible biases, which we talked about interacting in how we give testimonial credibility to individuals and so on.
Yeah, so of course, so what Jordi just talked about is, let's say, from the perspective of people who should be granting certain credibility, but of course there's a other side of the coin where there are people who might be receiving less credibility, or those who might require, you know, additional know-hows or, you know, awareness of how to navigate unkind epistemic environments. And here, what I have advocated in the past, and I have argued it in my previous paper that was recently published, basically what I think is important for an epistemically responsible agent is to have something called discernment as an epistemic virtue, where you're able to discern whether a circumstance is exploitative or it's a context where in which you can really engage in an earnest conversation for the betterment of the party who may be biased, but may be biased for a benign reason and not in a, a pervasive and repetitive manner. So when you're engaging with certain, you know, epistemically, let's say, uncooperative parties, you can lend yourself to situations where you know that you will expose yourself, epistemically speaking, by trying to be a knowledge giver, trying to, for instance, advocate for a mathematical camp that you belong to. But you sometimes know that the listening party simply will not budge and is just probing you in order to expand what their thoughts are and to not give space to what you are thinking. In which case, I think you should have the virtue to be able to discern the situation as exploitative and then simply walk away. Right?
Yeah, that's probably a good statement, thinking about the haymaker debates and in the internet and things like that.
Exactly. And in certain cases, if you choose to do this, then it could be a really loss of opportunity to form allies or to really contest certain, you know, like assumptions that are scientifically held for the betterment of science, right? So this is a really important epistemic virtue that I think may allow these difficult epistemic terrains to resolve itself, of course, at an individual level. And because it's an individual level, it's not the only solution and it should not be the only solution. It's not a sufficient solution either. It's just but one side of what it means to cultivate a good epistemic environment for science.
That's lovely last words, because this is exactly what we try to do here, right? To have a nice epistemic environment, hopefully even in the comments section, which is not often the case in YouTube, but so far it was always great. Many questions, some critiques, some euphoric people, but that's always fine. So thank you so much for being here and for donating your time to our little podcast about logic. And
thank you very much, Dennis. This is a wonderful, wonderful project, and we view it regularly, so we'll recommend it regularly again.
We are royal followers, and we are very happy. I'm very happy and very honored to be here. Thank you so much for giving us time and space. This is an important platform, and I'm very happy that you have, that you are the host, because you also have a knack for it. So that's very nice.
Okay, I'm blushing. So I should just say once again, thank you. And to all other people, also follow this podcast by subscribing, ringing the bell, commenting, forwarding it to friends, and hyping it, whatever that means. So far, I think nobody did that. Not sure if we must turn it on, but we will figure it out. And once again, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.